NBA ASAP. NBA ASAP. Hello and welcome to another episode of NBA ASAP, where we explore business skills and knowledge so you can level up your expertise and learn skill sets that will make you more valuable at your job and career, or help you start something on the side, a little side hustle, or let you quit your job and start your own business. I'm your host, John Cousins. Let's get started. Hi, and welcome to another episode of NBA ASAP. Today, I'm very excited. My guest is Croft Edwards, and Croft is a thought leader and consultant on leadership, and he has designed a concept called Leadership Flow, where he takes leadership principles and uses as the metric if we get into flow states when we are leading and as our organization or whatever we're trying to create our vision around has flow state type effects to it. And a flow state, it's a concept from positive psychology, where a flow is also known as being in the zone. It's the mental state of operation when a person is performing activity that it is fully immersed in that, in a feeling of energized focus, full involvement and engagement, and enjoyment in the process of the activity. And you've been there many times with things like your hobbies or things that you love doing, and the time just goes by and everything seems to be perfect and you're flowing. And there's been a lot of work lately done on how to hack those states, how to get into those, how to drop into flow states. Stephen Kotler and Dr. Jamie Weil have a flow practice where they look into that for athletes, for musicians, for all kinds of people that want to get more flow into their life. The work initially came out of a guy's work called Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. It's a crazy name. I'll put it in the show notes and you can look at his book. His book was initially called Flow. It came out in the 1980s. And what Croft has done is Croft has taken these principles of flow and applied them to leadership. Very cool concept. And let me just read something from the back of his book, from Croft's book. Croft's book is called Leadership Flow, Perfectly Square. That's the name of the company that this is based on. And a story about learning to lead and transforming a company. Great book. I'll put a link to it in the show notes so you can check it out after you listen to this episode. I think you'll really want to. It's an excellent book. So Croft Edwards is a master certified coach, social media influencer, president of Croft & Company, and the genesis behind Leadership Flow, the method that brings individuals and organizations to their peak performance. And his idea is that there's a lot left on the table capacity-wise through an ineffective organization or organizations not performing at its peak, not in flow. So without further ado, let's get into the episode and hear what Croft has to say about Leadership Flow. So Croft, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, John.
It's a pleasure. You and I have been friends for quite a while now, and you know, it's really interesting. As we've talked, as we've gotten to know each other, I've known you as a buddy, and then. And I know you're, a professional, but then when I actually read your book, I was just so impressed. I mean, it was just so, it's amazing how someone can come across in a written thing so powerfully. And the name of your book is Leadership Flow, Perfectly Square, a story about learning to lead and transforming a company.
Yes.
I think that says it all. But
it does. Yeah, it's sometimes the title can be a bit much for people, but basically Leadership Flow is my methodology. And then Perfectly Square is the title of the book. And we chose Leadership Flow Perfectly Square because it's actually the first of either three or four more books that are going to come out. And each one will be Leadership Flow and then the next title of the next company. So There is a method to the madness.
Fantastic. So each one will be Leadership Flow, and then so Perfectly Square is the name of the first company, and then
yep.
So each one is going to be done on that type of format or template where you're going to have a company as sort of the parable or the story around the yep. lessons.
Yeah, they're narratives, and it's basically a business parable. But I found those were so much easier for at least for me to write, and I wrote in that format specifically because I had a lot of clients that are leaders in organizations, and one of their challenges was, I'd bring them, hey, read this book. Well, it's a 350-page book on some subject, which I found super interesting. But a lot of them said, you know what, I don't find that interesting. And they don't want to read 350-page books. So I said, all right, I'm going to write a book that somebody could sit down on an airplane, and before they know it, the flight's over, and they've read the book, and they said, you know what, this is a fun little story that took me away.
Well, and that's a great point, and it's interesting that was easier for you to write that way from a story, because I think it's easier for me certainly to read and then to digest the information. And yeah, you do a great service by writing a smaller volume that distills that information out of the, like the 350-page tomes that, oh my gosh, would be great to read. But right, people have the good intention of reading it, but then it sits on their shelf for a long time and they never read it, where this is approachable. So you start reading it, suddenly you're in 25 pages, you can sort of see daylight at the end of the tunnel, and it's like it you have enough momentum to carry you through. So you actually get all the information, and it's given in such a palatable way where you start and you're going through the story. And I think stories are really, really good because they give you more of a mnemonic device, a way to remember, a context for fitting in, instead of like, here's the four precepts or whatever, and do this, do that. When you see how things evolve, what the challenges are that people meet, and then here's the resolution, here's how to do it. It tends to stick more, certainly in my mind. And so, really kudos.
Well, and I tried to write the chapters, each one was just enough that, oh, I've got 5 minutes, I can read a chapter. And not, because occasionally I'll get into a book and I'll go, this is great, but I look and I'll go, oh my God, this chapter's forever. But I wanted something that people go, oh, okay, I read this chapter, and in theory, the chapter was good enough that they go, okay, I'm going to read just one more chapter. And then, that added a new variable, I'm going to read one more chapter. And before they knew it, they're through the book. And it was, I think it was Mark Twain that said something like, I'm sorry this letter was so long, I didn't have enough time to write. And I tried to really do that, kind of write it a good story that I don't need the extra 100 to 200 pages. Hopefully the story and the content stand on their own.
Right. Yeah. Sorry, this letter is so long, I didn't have time to write you a short one. Because to write short, is actually a real, that's a skill and a craft. And you have to actually think about distilling the information, cutting out all the fat or the sort of peripheral stuff, and just delivering the meat and potatoes.
Well, and part of it too is I'm kind of lazy. And so I was like, oh man, if I wrote, there's the business books, which I'm not against in any way, but there's the book that'll explain some methodology or something, and it goes deep into the research and then this and that. Well, I have a master's in Civil War history. So I've done enough academic writing that I go, if I'm going to write all this stuff, I'm going to have to go get sources. I'm going to have to cite the sources. And I didn't want it to be academic. I wanted it to be something where people go, oh, I get this idea. And where I needed to, I gave credit. In the book, I don't claim that a lot of this stuff, oh, I invented it. It's just, here's my teachers. But there's not one specific spot where I took this from. It's my learning. And I tried to make the story, though, fun. And at the end of the day, people go, wow, this was fun, and I learned something along the way, and I might even read it again.
Well, and those are a couple of good points there. On a pedagogical level and on a management level, leadership level, to deliver things to people in a palatable way where they're actually going to take that first step and then be drawn in. And like you say, oh, this is enough. I can read this chapter. There's not a barrier at the front like, geez, I'm going to have 2 hours before I read the next chapter and then stop doing it. And once you start that, then you lose that momentum, and you kept up that momentum. And figuring out how to make it so that people would actually get involved and dig deeper and read into it. That not only it's a sort of a great for the book, but it's also a great instructional lesson just for a leadership style.
Yeah. Well, and one of my clients actually, what they're doing, his senior team, they're reading the book, but he has his staff, they're not a lot of readers. So his homework is, we're going to just read these six chapters. And so they read the first six chapters, and then they're going out and they're going to view their world through the eyes of those first six chapters of what are the conversations that we're having effectively, ineffectively, and failing to have. And then that's going to lead. And then once they kind of get through that and play with that and digest that, then they're going to go out and read the next four chapters. And it's just enough that, okay, here's a framework. Let's go look at our organization through this framework. And so to me, it was really cool because I kind of had that thought in the back of my mind, but when he said, no, here's what we're going to do, it was really, I felt great because it was like, oh, then it's hitting its target market.
Yeah, excellent. And then those bite-sized chunks, the whole adage of a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. If you can get those in those bite-sized chunks where they're not just bite-sized, but they're meaningful nuggets so that they can then go and look through that lens and see how we're doing. And it gives them a great tool to have like a sort of a reading group, but then they're actually going and everybody's getting on the same page at the company.
Well, and it's like the opening chapter in the book starts off in a staff meeting. And that was such an easy place to start because I've been to tons of them. And I think most people in organizations have been to them. And we've all been in those types of meetings where everything gets discussed and nothing gets discussed and nothing gets solved. And people leave going, where are we even going? So that was kind of is part of it too. I was trying to create scenarios that people could identify with because we've all been in a meeting going, I have no idea what we just covered. And I walked out going, okay, I still don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. So it was kind of tying all that together. And it was fun because once I kind of had the idea, it really kind of happened pretty quickly.
Well, and that you address a lot through the drama of the narrative, a lot of the dysfunctional scenarios that people encounter. And so everybody knows those scenarios. And so when they can relate to them, that's another way that draws them in. Yeah.
Yeah.
The precepts of the book, you had talked about the one, the different types of communications, that everything's a communication, everything's a conversation, and there's three different kinds, right? There's the effective ones, the ineffective ones, and the ones that just haven't happened, the null set.
Or the missing,
And so that's a great way to start looking right there. You can look at everything and see, is this a good conversation or a bad one or one that needs to be have but hasn't happened yet?
Yeah. Well, and in a way, we even talk about it, a way to tell if you're having effective conversations is you're satisfied, right? Mm-hmm. You're getting the results you want. Well, the conversations you're having then have to be effective.
Right.
The ineffective conversations are where we know we're dissatisfied. And so we know this isn't working and we keep having the same conversations expecting different results. And then missing conversations are those things that either A, we're just kind of having with ourselves, or they're kind of a feeling but we're not really acknowledging it and going, you know what? I need to go there. So as an example, I have a sibling that there's missing conversations right now. And both of us know it, but neither one's really even an acknowledgement of it. They're just kind of like, oh yeah, whatever. Life is the same. So that's a framework that I can go out in my world, in my personal life, where am I happy? Where is my life the way I want it to be? Where isn't it? And then that's where I can start to go, okay, so where are the breakdowns? What are the requests I need to make? Where are we just not having those conversations and how can we have them?
That's really important. And that's another big issue that this your book and your techniques are not just good for business situations, but like you say, family life, other parts of your life where there are frictions or dysfunctions or things, and how do you solve them? That you hear people talk a lot about not talking about the elephant in the room or the 800-pound gorilla in the room or something. That everybody acknowledges that something's there, but that discomfort of starting that conversation.
I always maintain we're actually having the conversation. The problem is I'm only having it with myself. So it's an ineffective conversation. So I have an issue with John, but I won't tell John it. And so I'm sitting here, and I'll tell everybody in the office but John. So I'm having conversations. The problem is they're ineffective because John doesn't know that I have an issue with him.
That's a good point. I think a lot of times we do that. We have these big conversations in our minds, you know, that we're working it all our time, but we don't have it with the other person, so it's completely ineffectual. And then I think sometimes people, and I myself included, we start to think you've had this big conversation, but it's been with yourself, and you think to some degree you project that on the other person, like they understand that you know what you've conclusions you've come to or whatever, without even ever having communicated that to them, and then you wonder why they're not acting the way you want them to.
Well, and so much of that then is tied to moods and emotions, right? Because I'm in a mood of resignation with this person, and I don't want to have the conversation because I already know how it's going to turn out. Well, I've already pretty much drawn up 80% of the conversation by the mood that I'm showing up in. So what if I could show up in a different mood and say, you know what? We aren't having effective conversations. And what if we could start having conversations about how we have conversations?
Right. So set some ground rules for the conversation, some guardrails or some sort of a...
Yeah. And so many times in organizations, we have no conversations. That's, in many respects, that's a missing conversation. We have no conversations about how we have conversations. Right? We don't sit down and say, okay, so here's how we need to start having conversations. We need to get good at listening to one another. But we can't even have that conversation about how we have conversations.
And I think that's key because a lot of the dysfunction of not having conversations comes from just some sort of discomfort on the front end of like, how do I frame this in a way that's not going to upset the other person and completely get a reaction that's going to go down a negative path right off the bat.
Yeah.
And if people are comfortable that here's our ground rules, here's how we're going to do it, then those conversations can start. Because I think that's really the big inertia on the front end is a reluctance to start those conversations maybe.
Well, and I would make the other thing we don't do is we don't practice, right? So if we look, you know, we're a society that's obviously very sports focused. So if you take a football game, we practice all week for 1 hour.
Right.
Well, in most businesses, it's as if we're playing the game all the time. And then occasionally we'll have one half of a training day or something, right? Instead of going, wait, let's practice.
Very good point.
And get good so that every day we're in the game, but we're playing it well because we know how.
Right.
And so that's, you know, a lot of organizations, the soft skills and stuff like this is, you know, it's a waste of money. It's we don't have the time or the budget. Okay, so what is it costing you?
Right.
To not have conversations, to not have effective conversations. And in almost every one of my clients, when we sit down and talk about it, they realize, you know, this little non-communication right over here cost us $1 million.
Right, quantifying those things.
$5 million because we, you know, we put a product out to market and it wasn't ready, but we didn't have the conversation beforehand. So, the soft skills are they're bottom line things. But the challenge is a lot of organizations we see so shallowly. We go, oh well, you want me to spend how much on training? But I won't hesitate as an organization to spend a ton of money to teach somebody how to use a machine. But we spend no money to teach people how to communicate.
Right, and that's so key. I mean, and I think a lot of people too in an organization, you have people with different needs. Everybody's sort of siloed. You have marketing, and you have an accounting, and finance, and sales, and those people don't know how necessarily to bridge those gaps and talk with each other. And that's really where a lot of misconversations happen, I think, where, you know, the ability to talk and understand everybody's, so all the goals, everyone is synced in the same way. So you're moving in the same direction.
Yeah. And so the other place I really go, I always go to the top because it's the conversations that leaders make a priority are the conversations that happen. Right. And so you need look no further than politics. And this isn't about politics or choosing sides. But when, for instance, Obama was president, there was different conversations. Now that Trump's president, there's different conversations. And I'm not saying one is right or one is wrong, but rather leaders determine what conversations we have.
Right, they frame
so if in my organization something is or isn't happening, It's because I've set the conditions for those conversations to either happen effectively, ineffectively, or fail to happen. So it's always a leadership issue.
That's a great point, because it should be. You know, leaders need to take ownership of everything, basically. You know, the buck stops here. And yep. to give leaders a framework for how to effectively deal with this issue, that's a great asset, a great tool that you're providing. Yep. So that I'm responsible, but then, well, how do I affect that responsibility in a meaningful way?
Yeah, and a lot of times I brought into an organization, you know, we've got to fix John. So I'm hired to coach John to get results. But immediately my first thought is John's boss. Mm-hmm. Because if John isn't getting the results, what it tells me is his boss is not having effective conversations. So it's easy to go, hey, John isn't working, so go hire a coach to fix him. But what we're fundamentally saying, if I do that as a leader, hey, I don't know how to motivate or have the conversations with John, so go spend some money so that I feel good.
Right, and that's really abdicating their responsibility and just trying to placate it with some money and a tool. Instead of, you're right, it has to come from the top, because everybody is incentivized or disincentivized by the frameworks that are set up that they see. This is how I'm going to be measured. This is how my performance is going to be seen as either good or bad, and that's how I'm going to operate.
And that's why whenever an organization brings on a new leader, the organization will have to change, because that leader's having different conversations. Some are effective, some are ineffective, some are missing, but they're always different conversations. And they're allowing, you know, if I allow a behavior and the behavior, let's say, is inappropriate, that is actually, I've had a conversation and the conversation is very ineffective, mm-hmm. or it's missing. So it's on me as a leader, because if I see a behavior and I don't go at that point and, John, your behavior is unacceptable, we're going to have a conversation about whether you should even be a part of this organization. That's a conversation I can have. I can also choose to have a conversation by avoiding it completely. So it's always a leader. So the whole premise of leadership flow is that I, as a leader, determine what conversations happen, and then that determines what's possible in the organization, which is either my people are in flow, they're at their best, or they're at some level below that.
Excellent. Yeah, and taking these implicit elements and making them explicit, where everybody understands what the rules of the game are and what the conditions are, what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. Well, and you just mentioned flow, and I think that's a nice segue to talk about the concepts of flow relative to leadership and leadership flow. And how did you initially come up with, you know, or understand, you know, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi and
About 5 years now ago, I was doing a rebranding of my company, and my branding partner, this amazing lady named Emily Aiken, we were talking and kind of setting up where we're going to work together and all that. And she very astutely said, you know, you're a flow junkie. And I said, what do you mean a flow junkie? And she described it. And I'm one of those people that I'm always doing stuff. I'm a woodworker. I'm a runner. I have a small farm, so I'm always building stuff. I'm always out there. And I'm always just driven by that energy, and I feel alive. And so once we kind of explored it, she said, here's this concept that it's emerging called flow. And I started to look into it. I was like, oh my gosh, that's amazing stuff. And what really jumped out at me was the concept that, what if this is like the holy grail of leadership, which is the goal of leadership is not to just get results. The goal of leadership is to bring people alive. Because when everybody's at their best, the results will take care of themselves. And so that became the genesis of leadership flow, which was, what are the skills necessary to create flow in an organization? And it's tied to, you know, the conversations, effective, ineffective, or missing. Well, if we're having effective conversations, chances are we're getting closer to flow.
Everybody's in flow.
Yeah. And so that's the whole premise. And so once I started really studying flow, it was like, oh, yeah, it just made sense. You know this. If I'm loving my job, I can't wait to get up in the morning. I'm showing up at work. I'm making people's days better. my results are likely going to be somewhere in there, right? But if I hate my job and, oh God, I don't even want to get up tomorrow, what's possible?
Well, yeah, exactly. And with my understanding of flow is that fellow Mihai Csikszentmihalyi started to look into sports figures and all, and how these people or musical performers and things, when they got into that place, and we've all experienced it where we're just, everything's going right. We're in that zone and things are just flowing. They're moving along and we can do no wrong. And just if you're a sports, you know, baseball guy, and suddenly you hit 3 home runs, 3 times at bat, you just feel perfect. You just sunk 18 baskets in a row. Those kind of feelings, you know, even when we drive down the street and 3 green lights in a row, we're just in that kind of that flow state. And then how that can transfer over into everyone's life, and how do we find that, and how do we get there? And there's lots of talk, you know, when you look at dysfunctional organizations or even people in their jobs, the whole idea even of TGIF, right? Thank God it's Friday. I mean, that's sort of implicitly or saying, you know, God, thank goodness my week is over. Now I have the weekend. Now I can do the things that I like, and I don't have to do this job thing. And the same thing with, you know, I don't like Mondays, or, you know, Monday blues, or the Sunday night blues. Those kind of things speak to people's dissatisfaction with what they're doing in their job. And if you come with that kind of attitude, obviously, you're right. Like you say, what can be accomplished? Not certainly peak performance. You're not going to be thinking as creatively, acting as, you know, as high performance as you can, where you get so involved in a task that 5 hours go by and you didn't look at the clock and, oh boy, it's 2 o'clock. I missed lunch at noon. How could that happen? You know, instead of like, oh, 11:30, I can't wait for another half hour so I can escape for an hour or something.
Yeah, and what, you know, Csikszentmihalyi's original work was, they were looking at happiness. What makes people happy? And what they found was there wasn't one thing. Rather, they found it when they were doing what they love. The participants kind of talked about this flowy state where things were flowing. And and as Csikszentmihalyi studied this, there was some interesting things. But one of the things that kind of talks to what you were talking about is, research has proven that to have a flow state, I have to be where the challenge that I'm facing is just above my abilities, right? So, you know, think about it. If I have young kids, if they don't know how to ride a bike, well, they're going to – the challenge is above their abilities. So when my kids learned to ride the bike, it was so much fun. They were so alive. You could see they were beaming. But if I said, okay, 10 years from now, and you and I we're now way past that, all we get to do is ride our bike in circles around the house, we're going to get bored very quickly.
Right. It loses its
So there's got to be a challenge. So many times when somebody says, you know, God, it's Mondays, what I hear is, oh, you don't have anything that challenges you. You're doing the same repetitive task, and you're bored. So a lot of one of the things we're working on in leadership flow is finding out ways where are people's cutting edge to where they're always growing. Because if I'm not growing, I'm dying kind of thing. And so many people, they have jobs that it's, you know, one of my favorite sayings is eight in the gate. I just put my 8 hours in and then I go home. Well, what if we can make work so much fun? And we allowed people to get creative when it comes to how to increase productivity. So like the Lean Six Sigma and all of the quality programs, a key piece of all of them is employee involvement. People have to be allowed to shape their future. They have to be challenged. And when they're not, they just go, all right, whatever, I'm just going to show up. And so the challenge piece is critical for flow. And as a leader, you know, if I'm in the same job 30 years later, I'm going to probably not be that very effective as a leader. My background is the military, and one of the things the Army does very effective, and the other branches do too, is you don't stay in the same job that long. Mm-hmm. You're generally there just long enough to get good at it, and when you're good at it and you think, okay, now I'm an easy street, you're yanked out and given a job with more responsibility. Because it keeps you going. And all of a sudden, something that, you know, seems so hard is easy. Well, now we're going to take you to a next level and really challenge your ability to grow. And Csikszentmihalyi, just to wrap this up, found that there were a lot of moods tied to that. So, you know, when I'm in boredom and apathy, I'm not being challenged. So we have to figure out ways to challenge people to create flow.
That's key. I've heard that there's sort of a flow challenge. If you have the, you know, the task and the skills on two different axes, there's that sort of channel where if your abilities are really a lot and the challenge is low, then you have boredom. If the challenge is really high and your skill sets are not there, then all you have is stress. You just become panicked and you can't act either. So you have to have the right sort of balance where you're dialing in, where it's just a little bit. I've heard even, you know, people say 6% more challenge than skills or something like that. So you're in this interest. I don't know how you measure that, but that's exactly what it has to be. And like you say, through learning and continual improvement. And I think that's one of the great parts of leadership is developing your human resources, developing people so that they're actually, you can see them always growing. You're giving them enough latitude and scope to define their future and control things within the bounds of what needs to be done so that they feel like they have agency and that they're being listened to and that they can also continually improve.
And we can even have conversations of, look, I know your job is boring. And I can't change, you know, this aspect of your job. However, what could I change so that you show up to work going, this is where I want to be. This place is going to get above and beyond. And that's through the conversational piece, which, again, the goal of a leader is to find flow.
Right. And having a, not only having an organization that's actually a learning organization, because in this day and age, there's no stasis for an organization, even where it's this monolith and it's going to be the same for the next 20 years, and you can move up this sort of hierarchy. The external environment is continually changing. Technology, all kinds of things are completely, you know, continually evolving. So the organization has to learn along with all of its members learning more so that everything can dial in to be effective in the external environment as well. So.
And, you know, it's even biological. So I'm a runner, and it's so easy to get like, oh, I'm going to run 5 miles, and then tomorrow I'm going to run 5 miles, and then a week from now I'm going to run 5 miles. And pretty soon my body goes, I can do 5 miles.
Right. You push yourself, a little bit, right.
If there is – so like the whole premise of the high-intensity or high-intensity interval training
hits,
is to just – you're constantly challenging your body where your body goes, oh, I didn't do this before. That's a challenge. But that can happen. It's so, you know, I see this all the time. If I'm not growing with my running, pretty soon I get bored and I almost get lazy and I run the same route every day. And pretty soon I'm like, yeah, this isn't fun anymore.
Yep.
I've got to change it up.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that's, I think, the whole premise behind a lot of different, like CrossFit, where every day it's a different workout. You're using your body in a different way, so your body doesn't have that muscle memory and things, that take over and just sort of say, okay, time for my run. I'm going to sleepwalk through the run or something. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. And the other thing is that a lot of times what can happen, too, in the alternate way is I'm not open to the new change. And so then the moods start creeping in of, oh, God, I don't like this. And already I start creating a story. Mm-hmm. And the story now starts to override that. And so a lot of what we do in coaching is get people to see, how are you observing this? And transformational coaching looks at, now, instead of changing the actions you're taking to get different results, what if you changed how you looked at it?
Ah, good point.
How you show up. And so a simple example, if the meeting tomorrow is going to be bad, I've already determined a lot of what's going to happen.
Right.
But what if I could say, you know what, I'm going to figure out a way to make tomorrow's meeting fun. All of a sudden, it's already a different potential future that we could create.
That's a great point. Yeah, but the other part, right, people like the comfort and the safety of the predictable. So when you start moving people out of their comfort zone, a lot of times that could be exciting for people, like I'm learning, I'm growing, I'm developing. But like I say, on the other side of that, there's this fear of the unknown. You know, and basically a lot of that comes from, how am I going to be judged, right? And so there has to be a, from the top, the leadership area, laying down those rules that you won't be you know, immediately dinged for any type of missteps or something like that as you learn in this new role, so that people can feel comfortable that they're supported in that role and they're not sort of like hung out to dry in some way or set up to fail or.
Yeah. Well, I think it's there's a sad side of all of this, too. When, you know, when you see this, people start with a job and they get to a level where, OK, I'm comfortable. And then they coast the rest of their career. And it's almost like their life ebbs out of them.
Mm-hmm. And so
if we can't start addressing it again, that may be a missing conversation, because if I have somebody on my team that's just showing up for eight in the gate, that's a missing conversation. If I'm not saying something about it, saying, wait, the conversation may be, I realize you've been here 20 years. However, that's not a guarantee you're going to be here the next 10 years. We got to have a conversation. We need you to show us that you're engaged, that you're committed to this organization. So that may be a conversation that I don't want to have as a leader. But if I don't, what I'm saying is for the next 10 years, we're going to let this person just waste oxygen. Guess what that's going to do to other people? Guess what that's going to do to our organization? So, you know, this isn't just touchy-feely stuff. There's also the value of sometimes we have to have difficult conversations. And that may be painful in the short run, but it's going to help the organization in the long run by creating flow for others.
Right. Help the organization and help the individuals. Right. Because if you have one, that toxicity tends to spread if one person is in that way. And I think that's where an organization changes from being dynamic and a learning organization and an evolving organization and starts to ossify into a bureaucracy, you know, where just people are just, you know, stamping the whatever it is and just going through the motions.
We have this image of, you know, being a government bureaucrat where all I do is follow the rules.
Right.
And, you know, hey, I've been to some departments of motor vehicle where I'm going, oh, my gosh, you know, 3 hours later, put me out of my misery. Right. And that it doesn't have to be that way. Right. I've been to one, the state of Michigan's Secretary of State. They actually had a pretty you went to the Department of Motor Vehicles and it wasn't the best experience I've ever had. But I could tell they were continually trying to make it better. And you could tell. But I've been into some where it's like, oh man, there's a mindset that, oh, I've got this great retirement, and I don't fault them. This isn't about faulting them. That's a leadership issue.
Right.
Because what's going to happen is over time, if I learn that taking initiative is going to be punished, I just start going, fine, I'm not going to take initiative. So when I see an organization that there isn't flow, it isn't the employee's fault.
Right.
It's a leadership fault. It's always a leadership fault, because if leaders aren't willing to have different conversations, we can't change the culture.
Right. Like you said, always look to the boss. Who is setting the tone of this, that because people will just fall into that kind of place. And yeah, you do. It's so sad when you see, like you say, the life just ebbs out of people. Like they just don't look engaged. They just don't have that type of joy or enthusiasm or looking. How can they make it better? How can they get things, you know, done and done in a better way? I like that saying. It used to be the saying for Facebook, where, you know, move fast and break things. You know, just keep going. And if errors happen or whatever, or, you know, fail fast, fail forward, those kind of, you know, there's been a lot of sort of cult culture around failure as a good thing. But if you can set that up as a support, that you're not going to be penalized, because people can be risk averse. And if it's like, well, if I do something and I'm going to be punished for that, but if it turns out good, I'm not going to see any reward, well, that's an asymmetric kind of situation where they're going to obviously opt for the side where do nothing is better for them or safer than doing something. And if it goes bad, you get punished. And if it goes good, you get no reward for it or no recognition or anything. It's human nature that they'll optimize for that behavior, and it's not going to be the beneficial one.
Yeah. And you see that all the time. Organizations will, somebody messes up and the answer is to fire them.
Right.
Well, you just paid all this money for this training and you're not going to use it. Because there's I worked a lot with mines, and I was at one mine, and it was interesting that the one man that was an absolute zealot around safety had been in another mine, and five of the people on his team were killed.
Wow.
So he never took safety for granted, and he was willing to have any conversation with any person at any time about safety. He was the epitome of what safety should be, and he was fanatical about it. And he was such an asset to the organization because he knew firsthand why safety mattered.
All right, a painful lesson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so when these things happen, instead of going, oh, well, John, you messed up, there's the door. Yes, if John continually messes up doing the same thing, yeah, that's probably going to be the best place for him. But if John messes up, let's have a conversation about, okay, so we just spent a lot of money on you. How are we going to get a return on this investment? What will it take? You know, what can you do to learn from this to bring that value to the organization? That can be amazing results when John goes, oh, one, they value me. Two, they value me enough. They didn't even fire me. They want me to learn from this. I'm now going to be the poster boy or poster girl for the organization about why this matters.
Right, because doing that sacrificial lamb thing, I mean, that's just a symptom of greater problems, and you're ignoring the greater problems, the root causes, and just sort of getting rid of what you know you think is the result, but it's just a symptom of deeper things.
Well, and the witch hunt feels good because we can tell people, you know, we performed a witch hunt and we got everybody out of the system.
Identified what the problem was.
Yeah. You know, the Army struggled with this, the zero defects kind of, you know, career progression. Well, it creates a lot of yes people. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to rock the boat. And they've gotten a little bit better at it. But at the same time, I want those people that have made mistakes, because if they've learned from them, they're even more valuable. They now know I can't go down this road. Whereas somebody who hasn't, they may be tempted to go down that road because they haven't felt it. And again, this is all kind of tied to flow about, you know, if I'm somebody that makes a mistake and my organization has conversations about, okay, what'd you learn from it? What can we learn from this? What can we do to keep you because we value you? That's very different conversations than you're on super secret probation for the next 6 months. And if you even look at somebody wrong, there's the door.
Right. That type of learning environment and that being comfortable with that, just like it's having those postmortems or after action kind of meetings and trying to understand what went wrong, what was the thing, and if people can learn from them, they're going to be much better employees. And treating the whole idea, I think it was a great change of language when we started calling employees, you know, the whole human resources and thinking of it as resources and resources to develop and get value out of an added value.
It's great stuff. One of my clients, it's a coal mine, and underground they have basically small trains underground, and they have the manual switches like you'd see in the old Western movie where I'd have to pull the switch so the train could go to the left as opposed to the right.
Wow.
Well, these switches have what are called stored energy in them, right? So there's kinetic energy. I'm not a physics major, but long story short, an employee who didn't have the right training stuck his finger in there and got his finger cut off.
Oh.
And to hear the leaders talk about, well, he should know better and this is BS. But then the day before, I would hear the same person say, you know what? We can't even get good people around here. And my point is, I know where the issues are, right? Because the day before you were saying you can't get good people. If you can't get good people, the ones you get, you better train the heck out of them, and you better be sure that you teach them like things like this that they don't know, because you're saying they don't know. But then the next day when they make a mistake,
then it's their responsibility. Yeah.
That's their fault. No. Which is it? It's got to be one or the other. And
the other.
If it's the employee's fault, then it means it's your fault too.
Right. Because you have to train them.
You didn't train them. You didn't have the conversation. You didn't ask them, hey, do you know what this means? And so this happens all the time. And again, it always goes back to leaders. Leaders are the ones that have the conversations that are effective, ineffective, or missing, which then determines how people show up. Are they engaged? Are they fully committed, i.e. flow? Or are they something less than that? Regardless of the conditions. And, you know, I always tell people, take the best job you've ever had and now do that job under your worst boss. or take the worst job you've ever had and do that under your best boss, which job will you stay at longer?
Right.
You'll always stay for the boss, right? And that's an unwavering trend that has been proven time again. The number one reason people leave organizations is their immediate supervisor. There's a lack of flow. I don't feel alive when I work for this boss. In fact, I feel something opposite that.
I can talk from my experience. I totally agree with you. The places I left, it was because I just felt, I was so uncomfortable and bad with the boss.
My wife has an amazing boss that she would literally, if this boss said, hey, we're it doesn't matter. My wife would be like, I'm game.
Right. That kind of loyalty. Right.
And my wife at times has talked to this person about, hey, I'm unhappy here. When she worked for her, I'm thinking of quitting and leaving your team. And this boss said, great, let's have a conversation on it. So now the boss wins because she wanted to know why my wife was unhappy. And because she knew that, then she could say, okay, let's figure out a way to make you stay. And they've had a great relationship and both have benefited. And most importantly, the company benefited.
Right.
That's the power of having effective conversations.
Right. All comes down to communication.
Yeah.
In the book too, you talk about there's four different parts to getting to the leadership flow. I'd like to just talk about those a little bit.
Yeah. So, when I initially did my research, when I was with clients, I found there was four things I kind of always talked about. One was the culture you have is 100% perfect to get the results you're currently getting. The second was there's two critical things a leader does. The first is create a vision that people want to be a part of. And the second part of that is that leader creates other leaders and teams committed to that vision. And then the third thing, which is actually the fourth thing I said, which is the most difficult person you ever have to lead is yourself. And I started playing with those things, and then I realized there is a methodology here because the organizational culture we have is perfect to get the results we're currently getting. So if we want a different culture, because the culture fundamentally is what and how we do things, how things get done in our organization. So if it isn't working, we have to create a different one because the only thing possible in our culture is what our culture allows. So that became the first, which is creating culture and expanding capacity. So that was the first piece. And then I said, okay, so if the culture we have is perfect to get the results we want and we need to change it, we got to have a vision of what we want. And not, yes, we want sales to be up 20% next year. Yeah, that's a very small part of it. But fundamentally, how do we want people to interact?
Mm-hmm.
If I walked into my store or my office, could I 5 years from now go, oh my God, they're doing it. They're treating people the way they want to. And so that became visioning the future. And then to do it, to create this organization, we had to have other leaders and teams all working towards this vision. And then that became cultivating other leaders and teams. And at its core then is self-mastery, because the biggest challenge I have as a leader is not my team. It's me.
Managing
it's getting
yourself.
Me out of the way. It's showing up in a mood and emotion that's positive when I don't want to. Right. And so then this became kind of, and it all kind of came together around the flow piece, because if I'm practicing effective conversations, I've got people committed to a vision, our culture is going to start to evolve that way. And it by nature will have to have people at their best. So we're starting to create
Excellent.
This culture through how we interact with others. And again, at its core, though, it's ultimately I'm my biggest challenge. If I want a different culture, I have to shift how I show up. And those are things that I can practice. And that stuff, obviously, you go deeper. There's more to it than that. But that's fundamentally the methodology.
That's excellent. And it all – yeah, right. It all stems or emanates from the leader – taking responsibility. You have to be the change that you want to see, and then you can emanate that out. And then pushing down the decision making so that you're building more leaders, and they understand that they have more flexibility, they can have responsibility, and they're not going to be punished for actions that they take that may be that may go awry because everybody's bought into this on the front end. One of the things I'd like to talk about, the first, creating culture and expanding capacity. Yeah. What do you mean by expanding capacity?
Basic premise is if our culture is where we want it to go, we're going to have more capacity, mm-hmm. right? Because how much waste is there in ineffective conversations? So you and I can't coordinate our action, and we end up repeating the same conversation 10 times and still getting bad results. So as the culture starts to evolve, we're going to have more capacity, right?
Right.
So I always tell people, you don't change organizational culture. What has to happen is individuals within that culture change. They then start to have different conversations with one another, which by definition means you have a different culture.
Mm-hmm.
And the more effective our conversations, we're not wasting time having the same conversation we've had 10 times.
So you don't have all those frictions and loss of resources.
Yeah. Negative moods are waste. Now, if I'm an astute leader and I'm very grounded and very aware of who I am, the moment I see John's in a negative mood, that's a conversation we need to have.
Right. Signal.
It could be John's going, hey, I got too much stuff going at home. So my role as a leader may be to say, okay, how can I help let you get through that and help you through that so that when you come back, you're fully committed.
And it could be people are underappreciated yeah. or feel overloaded or don't have the resources to do the job they are expected to do.
Yeah, and the model has shown it's circuitous, but there's not one place you just start and you go here. It's not linear. I show it linearly, or I show it in a circle.
Iterative.
Yeah, but they're all intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
We're always working on getting clear on what is our vision of the future. We're right. always building more leaders and teams, and we're always either growing ourselves, or by definition, we're dying and slowly, you know, and then it goes back to flow. I've got to be continually challenged to keep growing.
Right.
Right. And so if I'm not, I'm going to start doing the easy way, the path of least resistance, which now is likely going to frustrate resistance. Other people, and flow is going to start to slowly ebb away.
Fascinating. I mean, really, you know, it's a great paradigm, and I think anybody can get so much from this book, and you're helping so many different organizations, and all organizations can really benefit from what you have to say.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
How can people get in touch with you? What's the best way to communicate with you, through Twitter or other means? And where can they buy the book? Yeah. And where's the book available?
So yes to all those. I'm active on Twitter at Croft Edwards. My webpage is www.croftandcompany.com. You can find the book anywhere books are sold, Amazon. You can also go to leadershipflowthebook.com. And then don't hesitate to reach out to me. I love talking to people. I love exploring this concept. And then my email, croft@croftandcompany.com. Reach out and let's chat.
Fantastic. And I'll put all that stuff all that information in the show notes so that people can get a hold of you. People can get a hold of the book and, just great stuff.
All right.
I really appreciate you. Really appreciate being on the podcast. Anything else you'd like to add or something that...
No, I guess I would just leave you with, again, the most difficult person you're ever going to have to lead is yourself. And if I could lead me, everything else would be so much easier.
Everything emanates from there. I fully agree with you. And that's the hardest thing. And it's easy to know. And sometimes it's hard to really walk the walk on that
one.
It's
so easy to be blind to ourselves. Well, thank you so much, John. This has been a real pleasure.
Oh, I really appreciate it, Croft.
All right. Have a great day.
Take care. You too. Catch you later. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. The show notes are available on the website. Just go to mba-asap.com and click on podcast on the menu along the top. And there you'll find all things related to the podcast. Just scroll down and there are links to the show notes for each episode. If you have any questions or suggestions, email me at john.cousins@mba-asap.com. And follow me on Twitter. I'm very active there. My handle is at JJCousins. And send me a connect request on LinkedIn. I'd love to connect with you there. And go to the website and sign up for the mailing list. Thanks again. Until next time, peace.
MBA ASAP. MBA ASAP.